my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the rowdy road, many kinds I met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out, there's so much left to know when I'm on the road to find out.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the listen button. Today's show is pre-recorded, so we won't be taking any calls in the studio as we normally do. If you'd like to comment, you can send me an email at unspun, U-N-S-P-U-N, at kkrn.org. Today, our guest is Professor Tim Garrett. He is currently the head of the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. After getting his doctorate in atmospheric science from the University of Washington in 2000, he spent 2 years as a Huber Fellow at Princeton Environmental Institute. He has been visiting professor at the Université de Lille and Université Blaise Pascal in France. Forgive my French, by the way. He is a co-founder and president of two startup companies, Faltech and Particle Flux Analytics. His research focus is the physics of clouds. He has developed simple, quote, simple physical models for describing civilizations' growth. While clouds and economics may seem disconnected, both are complex systems that evolve according to non-equilibrium thermodynamic rules, end quote. When not doing research, he teaches graduate and undergraduate classes at cloud physics, atmospheric radiation, and thermodynamics. He serves as a co-editor for the Copernicus open access journal, Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics. Though our guest is mostly focused on physics, I have asked him to be on the air today to talk about his models of civilization and economics and their implications for our future. As regular listeners know, climate change and solutions to the problems we are facing have been a focus of mine for quite a while. Now let's welcome our guest, Professor Tim Garrett. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. Obviously, so much of your focus is on physics, and we can get into some of your work with clouds maybe later, but I'd like to concentrate on your articles and your studies about civilization and energy. I've spent the better part of this week reading a lot of your articles, and you equate, or you actually tie the relationship between GDP and consumption of energy and CO2. You kind of tie all those things together. And I just like to maybe start off with as little scientific jargon as possible for our listeners and give us a short version of your view of civilization as a heat engine, more or less.
Yeah, sure. So civilization, when we think about everything in our world, I think we often think about things at a very local, personal level. We think about our own lives, the lives of the people around us. And our work, we go to work and go shopping, and it's sort of a small-scale perspective that we often have. Even when we think about environmental problems, we might think about, you know, thinking globally but acting locally. The perspective often as a physicist that is preferable to take is sometimes just to try to stand back as far as possible to try to see if all this complexity of our individual lives can somehow be simplified by looking at perhaps civilization as a whole. So that's the approach I tried to take myself, which was to say, well, okay, let's forget about even countries or people, but rather try to think about civilization as being like an organism, like maybe even an amoeba in a petri dish, or it could be any other organism that consumes energy in order to survive and maintain its existing operations, its circulations, everything that it does. So if we think about civilization as a whole, we have all the countries and all 7+ billion people in it, and we all interact in very complex ways. We do things ranging from international trade to just going to the grocery store to going to and from work to shopping on the internet, making Google searches, whatever it is. And all these activities, as a consequence of a very basic rule in physics, the second law of thermodynamics, must require a consumption of energy. This is unavoidable. So in order for us to do anything, we must take, to use physics words, high potential energy and dissipate it. We must take some energy that's potentially useful and then use it in order to do whatever it is we do. We can't escape this. We cannot do anything without consuming energy. And then the question becomes, well, where does this energy come from? Well, at the very local level, this becomes a rather difficult question because we have energy from many different sources and many different forms. But at the global level, at the level of civilization, it just becomes a much simpler problem. The only energy that's really available to us is the energy that comes from what economists would call primary energy supplies. And these are things that we're all familiar with, like oil and gas and coal and nuclear power, wind power, solar power, all these things combined are what provide that potential energy that we can dissipate in order to do whatever it is we do. So at one end, we consume this energy, and then somewhere much further down the road, after being used in many different ways, this energy gets dissipated as what we might call heat. So that's where the idea of a heat engine comes in. We consume high potential energy. We dissipate low potential energy, just heat that gets radiated into space eventually. And in the middle, we do what an engine does, which is we do all our circulations. These things I mentioned could even be a Google search. Information goes out, information comes back. It's like a piston in an engine. It goes up and then it comes down. These are the circulations that are powered by consumption of energy. So what I did was to try to think about this concept of, well, maybe it's civilizations like this, and then I tried to ask, well, how does this relate to economic quantities, like something that could be expressed in terms of, say, dollars? And there, what I did was I tried to think about, well, how does civilization grow? And civilization isn't fixed. We are growing. We've been growing for thousands of years. And there, thermodynamics turns out to be really helpful, because civilization isn't actually made of energy. We're made of matter. We're made of stuff that comes out of mines or out of forests, whether it's wood or copper or steel or whatever it is. And what this energy, this available energy, does is not only does it enable us to keep doing what we're doing, but also it allows us to extract stuff from the forests and from the mines so that we can build ourselves, so that we can grow. And it is by growing that ultimately we get bigger, and bigger things require more energy. And so there is a positive feedback loop that happens. What I mean by a positive feedback loop is that as we consume energy, we can incorporate more matter, and as we we incorporate more matter, that makes all our buildings and us even, more people, roads, whatever it is, we are able to access these reserves of matter, of wood and copper ore and whatever, even more efficiently than we were before. And that enables us to consume more energy and then grow even further into more sources of energy. And as we get bigger and bigger and bigger, the more energy we require to maintain ourselves. And it turns out this can be expressed economically. So it turns out that the GDP, the thing we're familiar with, the gross domestic product or the gross world product at the level of civilization, is an expression of this growth. And because there is a clear link to energy consumption, we can also make a clear link to things that are more closely related to my interests in atmospheric sciences. Because energy largely comes from fossil fuels, we can also relate global economic quantities now to things like carbon dioxide emissions. And that's where things get interesting. We start to be able to think about the economic problem as a physics problem. Can we predict economic growth? Well, sure. I mean, physics is really hard. I struggle with it, but it is physics. It is something that we can sort of work through and understand. Now we can start making predictions about the economy. And we can also start making predictions, too, about things like how much carbon dioxide civilization will continue to emit in the future.
Well, let's stop and think about what you call GDP, or our gross world product, if you will, because we're looking at the entire world as a system in this case. So if we look at that, that's a no-brainer. I mean, obviously, if you're going to produce products and services, you're going to take actions, whatever that is, you're going to burn up energy, whatever that source might be. So in your equation, though, you kind of make an extra little leap there that I don't understand, because maybe I have a different definition of wealth. I wouldn't call GDP wealth. I would call GDP like a snapshot of production, basically, which is obviously directly related to energy. But it's a snapshot of production. And so what are you equating? What's your definition of wealth in this equation? If wealth equals growth, equals consumption of energy, equals CO2, then obviously that wealth, what that definition of wealth is, could be very important as far as the society is concerned.
Mm-hmm. So there are many criticisms of the GDP. It doesn't encompass much of what we do in our lives. I mean, a common criticism of the formalism of GDP is that it doesn't encompass things like, for example, work at home, which doesn't get tallied as in the GDP as some sort of financial quantity. And I would totally agree with that criticism, except I don't think that's a flaw of the GDP. What the GDP expresses is the growth of wealth. It expresses the growth of civilization. It is not actually tied to the energy consumption itself, but it's an expression of how the system, how civilization as a whole, gets hungrier. So let's just take an example here. Let's take you or I or anybody else. Let's say we produce the gross GDP means gross domestic product. Let's say we have somehow, through consuming more food, rather more than we have dissipated through exercise and just living, then we'll get fatter. We've produced more of our body. And what happens when we get fatter? Well, as a general rule, as we get bigger, or we grow from childhood to adulthood, we get hungrier. We must consume more energy in order to maintain our body mass. So if we were going to draw an analogy here, the GDP is an expression of the increase in our requirement of energy, and that our wealth is a bit more like our body mass. It's more closely linked to how much energy we currently consume. Now, you think about what is our wealth? Well, there, I think traditionally in economics, wealth is thought about as one thing plus another thing plus another thing plus another thing. This house is worth however much, and then if we have five houses, then it's going to be five times as much in terms of wealth. I find that to be antithetical to how I would think about how the universe works. So when we think about wealth, I think it's more important to think about connections between things, about our relationships among aspects of civilization, whether it's us or between anything in civilization, rather than the things themselves. So let's say we take a bar of gold. I think we'd all agree a bar of gold is worth something. It's worth quite a lot. But if it's lost in the middle of the desert and nobody knows about it anymore, it's worth nothing. That bar of gold is only worth something. It only contributes to our wealth if it's part of a larger system where it has connections to other aspects of the system. So the way I think about wealth is that wealth is a measure of our connections within civilization. It's a measure of connections where connections are important because they represent our ability to dissipate energy. You cannot dissipate energy without there being one thing that's connected to another thing. There has to be a flow from high to low in order to dissipate energy, and that dissipation is along connections. So that's how I think about wealth. It's about our connections. It's about how we relate to one another. It's about, I think we all feel that we are more wealthy personally if we have more social contacts, for example. It's about the connections that give us the wealth. Then the trick becomes, how do we calculate the wealth? And that requires a bit of extra thinking. And there what I did was I calculated wealth as the accumulation of inflation-adjusted GDP over the entire course of history. It's the accumulation of production, like the accumulation of body mass over time, that leads to our current body mass or our current wealth. And there, it turns out to be a rather wonderful result, the result that's at the core of my work, which is that our wealth, calculated this way, from year to year to year to year, has the exact same relationship to civilization's rate of energy consumption. It works out that every $1,000 of wealth in every single year is tied to 7 watts of energy consumption globally. And that is an invariable constant for the past 40 plus years of data for which we actually have data.
Let me interrupt you there for a second to remind our listeners you're listening to Unspun, an Experiment of Truth-Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Professor Tim Garrett, head of the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. We're discussing the thermodynamics of civilization and how that affects our environment and climate change. Today's show is pre-recorded. We will not be taking calls in the studio because we're not live. Coming back, wealth is fat.
Basically. Or accumulated fat, yeah.
Accumulated fat, which is an interesting analogy because if you look at America, not only as human beings, individuals, but also as a nation, we're considered one of the wealthiest nations of all time, in history anyway, in any way we can gauge that. And also we suffer from more weight, fat-related, sugar-related, energy consumption-related on an individual basis, we would be the fat kid, borderline, diabetic. and it's an interesting analogy. And another question that comes out of this, because we're in a capitalistic system, is the question of wealth distribution, how efficient that is as far as being churned back into the system and growing the system in that way instead of scooping the fat, the cream, off the top economically and becoming bloated and fat and dysfunctional. So I think in my mind there has to be some relationship, and I know you don't go into this deeply, but there is some relationship to the distribution of wealth around the world, and also the health and the functionality of a body, including our governmental body, our physical body, whatever that body is. These things seem to be kind of related to what you're saying. And we get, and I think we need to move into the area of what the implications are of what you're saying, which, if I understand it, in order to be together wealth, more fat possibly, you're going to have to produce more and more and consume more and more energy. Do I have that
right?
That's
exactly right. That's exactly right. Yes, it's unavoidable. You can't be fatter and stay fatter and eat much less. It doesn't work that way. If you're fatter and you want to stay fatter, you have to keep eating more because your body's going to keep doing more and more stuff. You've got more blood cells. You've got more of everything in your body. And you're going to radiate more heat. And you have to sustain that with more food. And civilization is the same way. I mean, our bodies are complex organisms. Civilization is a complex organism. Sure, they're complex, but at the basic core level, there is this central relationship between how big something is and how much energy it has to consume. If we want to get more wealthy, it is unavoidable that we consume more energy and also more matter.
Well, there's a couple of variables in this equation. I watched a TED Talk with Bill Gates the other day, and you could also equate population growth with the same curve. You know, and I'm not sure that your curve is linear. It may be more exponential. I don't know how that works, and maybe you can tell us about that. But when we look at other variables like population and energy sources, then maybe we can do something there that would allow us to grow, but grow at what some people like to call a steady state. Or maybe there's an option there that we can, by maybe going to renewables, to get away from the carbon dioxide production and somehow bring that rate of increase in CO2 in the atmosphere and in the oceans down. What would have you worked through any scenarios that might work in our favor in the long run? Because what you're talking about is eventual collapse of civilization. We can't, it's not possible, like the Petri dish example you gave. Whatever bacteria you put in there, there's only so much energy in that Petri dish that can be consumed by that bacteria and allow it to grow and it grow its little civilization, the Petri dish. At some point, the curve drops off rapidly and they all die.
So maybe a couple of points here, because this is this is where the physics gets totally fascinating, for me at least, because now we're talking about how systems evolve through time. You brought up the steady state question. Steady states are useful idealizations of reality, but they are fictions. Nothing can ever be in steady state because things grow in response to their environment. As the thing grows, it's consuming more energy from its environment, so the environment's always changing. So the relationship between the system and its environment is constantly changing over time. And for that reason, it is impossible for the system to achieve any sort of steady state where it is either growing or staying a fixed size. Things constantly evolve over time. Things may look to be somewhat steady over some short period of time, but the reality is that everything is always evolving. And that leads to a second point, which is that nothing can continue growing for forever. Everything must eventually collapse. We look at a wave, and a wave might rise, and then ultimately it will run out of energy that caused it to rise in the ocean, and then it must eventually fall. Sometimes the question then is whether the wave will decay gradually or whether it will break and collapse. So there's two possible options there, which is one thing that gets interesting. One aspect of this with relation to civilization, and this is both amazing and I think somewhat frightening, is that right now civilization is growing faster than it ever has before. Typically throughout most of history, civilization grew at about a couple of tenths of a percent per year. So it was always growing, you know, perhaps through the, you know, between, let's say, 0 and 1,000 AD or something like that. It was, you know, it was growing, but just rather slowly. And then beginning around the Industrial Revolution, we discovered these incredibly tasty sources of fuel, like coal and then later oil, that enabled us to accelerate our growth faster and faster and faster, until at this point today, we are now growing at a rate of about 2.3% per year. Now, that may not sound like such a big number if we talk about, say, GDP growth or even growth of wealth. They are different things, but, you know, economists might say 2.3% per year. They might use a word like anemic, that, you know, this is actually a fairly small rate of growth. But let's put this into context. A rate of growth of 2.3% per year means that things double in a course of about 30 years. So let's think about that. That means that civilization will put on as much fat in the next 30 years as it has in all of its prior history. It will go from half, from one, basically, to two. That is extraordinary, because you think, if 30 years, well, that's in many of our lifetimes, 30 years, well, that means that civilization would, based on this anemic, as people might call it, growth rate, would be at a stage where it is consuming twice as much energy and twice as much matter as it is currently. And we already talk about the world's environment struggling under our current rate of growth. So this is where the point where myself and many other people start to think, well, at some point, something has to give. Either we run out of resources, or alternatively, perhaps we pollute the environment enough that we can't continue to grow. At some point, I don't see that growth can be continued. Eventually, it must switch towards decay.
The interesting part of that is we don't seem to see that, and not that growth rate you're talking about. I did a little math last night looking at the EPA's I think 2015 analysis of CO2 buildup in the atmosphere, and from 1970 to 2011. It averaged just over 2% per year, and going, you know, it's the same growth cycle. The CO2, which makes sense, obviously, when most of your sources of energy are from fossil fuels, then it's, if you had 100%, it'd be, you know, you could lay the graph right on top of each other. So, and it's close enough our energy consumption that we are going to grow that CO2 in the atmosphere at the same rate. And so, but we know this is the equivalent of defecating in your own nest. And so the growth will have some factors. We're already, according to a lot of climate scientists, we're already past the point, if you take all the greenhouse gases, including the current upshoot in methane, and these things are, and what else, ice loss, things like that that you work with too, you know, the albedo effect, all those things are leading to positive feedback loops, which means all of this will happen faster than we want to believe, in my estimation.
Mm-hmm.
And the worrisome part for people like myself that are somewhat aware, probably more aware than the average person, we already know how this ends. We know from history and anthropology, there's several historians, philosophers, anthropologists that would treat this same phenomena It's basically an organic phenomenon. It's this, you know, seeking more wealth, which, you know, more fat, if you want to call it, or more energy. But it gets more and more in there, like Joseph Tainer and Spengler and, you know, who else? Jared Diamond. Basically, what's happening as civilizations and empire grow, they grab more and more. They become less efficient. They burn more energy to get less energy back, which is where we're at. And so we see we're already in the throes of a civilization collapse, and we haven't even peaked out on the CO2 and greenhouse gas problems. So it doesn't portend in my mind too well. And so this, I don't know if we've become dysfunctional. And the other part of that you pointed out, this whole growth spurt since we've been using fossil fuels, this is a blip. This is actually an aberration of what would be normal growth and normal. So we're on the path to pretty much wiping ourselves out, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, but you could. I mean, part of this is that you could say we have always been on a path towards wiping ourselves out. I think this comes back to this basic principle, which is that all systems have birth, they grow, their growth eventually saturates, and then they decay. I personally take more of a fatalistic perspective on this, which is that, you know, this is not just inevitable, but it has always been inevitable. I think the question in my mind is not whether or not civilization will collapse, because it will. All things eventually collapse. Eventually, ultimately, the universe will probably collapse. That's a given. I think more the question is, what's this going to look like? Can we make a prediction of how things will unfold? And we're not necessarily talking about the distant future here. Since things are happening so rapidly currently, we are talking about timescales of the next, you know, a few decades. So these are things that are happening right now. And if we can use basic physics to understand how something as seemingly complex as civilization works, then maybe we can have a deeper understanding of how our world will unfold over the next 10, 20, 30 years. That is where, as depressing as some of the conclusions might be, that's where I think some of the pursuit of understanding this phenomenon can ultimately actually be rather fascinating. I mean, I do have kids, and I worry about their future. But then there's, of course, the academic interest of trying to understand where we're all headed.
Let me interrupt you one more time here, and I'm going to do this little bottom-of-the-hour announcements. You're listening to Unspun on KKRN 88.5 FM in Bella Vista. It's a community radio station, and it's funded by listeners. Excuse me. And underwriters like yourselves. If you'd like to support our efforts, go to our website, kkrn.org, and click on the donate button. I have a couple of announcements. Probably the most important one here is the Reading Climate Coalition and the First United Methodist Church, along with KKRN Community Radio, are co-sponsoring the screening of the documentary This Changes Everything by Naomi Klein and acclaimed filmmaker Avi Lewis. That will be February 16th, 6:30 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church at 1825 East Street in Reading. And for more information on that, you can call 530-243-2403. That's 530-243-2403. Or visit readingumc.org. The other thing I'd like to announce is we're planning a little dinner party fundraiser at 6 p.m. on March 8th at the Savory Spoon Restaurant in downtown Reading, featuring some of our favorite musicians, Jim Dyer and Jonathan Foster. You can't beat the combo. I mean, it's, you have the best food and the best music in town in one place in the same evening, and you can get to help KKRN bring you the best programming on the air locally. So it's a win-win-win, and I want you to mark it on your calendars, and hopefully I'll see you there. I'll be there. Well, let's come back to you, Tim Garrett. And for those who haven't been listening, just picking up, Tim Garrett is the head of the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. We're talking about the thermodynamics of civilization, what that means for our future, and what that means in terms of climate change and how that will affect us. So today's show is pre-recorded, and we won't be taking calls at the studio. So back to Professor Tim Garrett. Yeah, we were talking about the future, and I could think of a couple of issues or perspectives we could talk about what the human being can do, which is not always much, but it could be representative of what the society could do. Myself and a couple other friends that can afford to have enough fat to have converted over to solar, and we're producing more energy, at least on the electrical grid, than we're consuming. And the other part of that, of course, is the your car usage. I mean, that's a big one. And also where you get your food. So if you grow your own food, which some of us are doing or trying to, and, you know, have community gardens, get an electric car. I have one friend, he has two or three electric cars, and he's on solar. So is this a good model? Do you think, can you see what I'm saying? You convert some of that fat and you turn it into sources of energy that don't produce CO2, and at the same time you adapt a lifestyle that is going to conserve energy consumption.
So I used to take that perspective, and I live a fairly frugal lifestyle. My house is small. We line dry our clothes. I have a push mower, those sorts of things. And I continue to do those things largely out of habit, but I no longer believe that they contribute. That's not because I think the contribution is small, but rather I think that whatever we do, it ends up being a wash in the context of the larger constraints on civilization as a whole due to things like the availability of energy. Now, this is a bit discouraging, I must realize, but the situation here is that, let's say I consume less energy. Let's say I switch to solar power. And on the face of it, that sounds terrific. But by consuming less solar power, consuming solar power, I would be consuming, say, less fossil fuels. And I would be reducing the demand on fossil fuels due to my small contribution. By reducing the demand on fossil fuels from myself, fossil fuels then become more available, potentially cheaper, and more attractive to others. And so what that means is that because fossil fuels are useful, they're most certainly useful, my reduction of consumption may simply enable somebody else to consume more, so that at the end of the day, it hasn't actually made any difference at all. The correct perspective, I think, or at least the simplest, potentially most accurate perspective at looking at problems that are really of a planetary scale, such as climate change, is to treat the problem and consider the problem on these sorts of planetary global scales. And there, it looks like individual actions are entirely invisible to the behavior of the larger scale organism. Ultimately, I can model how civilization has evolved over the past, say, 60 years, knowing really only how about the discovery of energy reserves. That is sufficient to create very accurate what we call hindcasts, or like forecasts starting in the past, starting in 1950, that are able to predict current rates of energy consumption and GDP growth at the present. Really only knowing things like the fact that we discovered massive reserves of fossil fuels in the 1950s, and that civilization has evolved just as an organic response to this sudden availability of food. In this work, I do not see individuals. I would love to think that individual actions have the power to make a substantial difference to how things progress in the future. But ultimately, it looks more like civilization evolves as a response to things like the availability of reserves of fuel and matter, like steel and oil, iron and copper.
This brings us to the question, and my point about the individual action was that could be scaled up. And much like we scaled up certain types of production and focus in the 50s and the 60s on building out infrastructure, the Second World War, all of these things created great wealth, and they went in a direction that was more sustainable and more functional. Now, what I see is a lack of governance, and some people would say, yay, deregulation, but we have a lack of governance that seems to be, and many people have called it dysfunctional, people that are more politically minded than I, but if you cannot change, let's go back to the analogy of the human being. If I'm eating so much sugar, I'm destroying my health, destroying the body, and eventually, which I'll die, that would be the equivalent of civilization collapse or societal collapse. So I'm going to die, economic collapse. I have basically eaten myself to death. And what this would be directly correlate with our economy based on fossil fuels. If we know we're going to eat ourselves to death, well, we usually go to a doctor and he says, well, cut back the carbohydrates. You know, it just makes sense. And maybe you'll have to take this medicine for a while, which could equate to geoengineering or whatever you want to call that part of the analogy. But I see it as a direct analogy. So do we have the understanding and the will collectively to bring about a change? It seems you're more pessimistic than I am in that sense. And I think we have the models. You and I talked about Mark Jacobson, who I had on the show a few weeks back. And his model is 100% renewable energies, no fossil fuel usage by 2050. And, of course, we know there'll still be a little bit of that. But that would be the goal. And so why can't we get that in place? Why can't we at least shoot for that? Because I think you pointed that out. The source of the energy obviously is directly related to your original equation, because if you take the CO2 out of the equation, you take the fossil fuels out of the equation, now we got a better chance. Even if we may not grow as fast, and maybe that's not sustainable, and history says it isn't, then maybe this is all things we have to do if we intend to continue to exist as a civilization.
I think there may be a couple of responses here. I don't want to sound pessimistic, because it's not really the intent of what I'm doing. It's the intent of the approach I'm taking is to try to figure things out the way they are. It's not about providing recipes or goals, as, for example, Mark Jacobson, your prior interviewee, had been giving. But let's say that switching entirely to renewables by 2050 is possible. To me, that seems surprising, given that all our current infrastructure, not all, but a large fraction of our current infrastructure is based around the consumption of fossil fuels. We would would be talking about getting rid of our current wealth in order to pursue different wealth. Let's say we talk about our body. We carry our current body with us into the future to somehow get rid of one body and then replace it with another that consumes energy in an entirely different way is not something we really think of as being all that possible. But let's say we did switch to renewables. We are talking about a situation where the fossil fuels are still out there. The fossil fuels are still just as useful as they ever were. But somehow there is some global, and would have to be global to matter for climate change, accord that says nobody can consume these fossil fuels even though they are useful. I think politically that might prove to be a little bit difficult. But let's say it is possible. We are not out of the frying pan. Because what happens then is that, yes, we may be consuming a different type of energy that does not lead to CO2 emissions. But remember, civilization is still made of matter. What that energy enables us to do is it enables us to extract material resources from our environment. It is no accident, I don't think, that over a period since 1970, during which civilization has doubled its energy consumption, the biosphere has halved its biomass. So the fish in the sea are largely gone, as are the animals on the land. If we double our consumption yet again, as would happen by 2050, if we continue along the current path, whether it is from fossil fuels or from solar power, we are still talking about sustaining energy, civilization, through a consumption of matter. And that matter has to come from somewhere. And that is its own set of environmental issues. And then we go on for another 30 years. We've doubled again and again and again. Ultimately, we end up in a similar predicament, whether it is from global warming and climate change or whether it is from just taking everything out of the environment. We end up in a situation where continued growth may no longer be sustainable.
And I don't think that's, I mean, it's not, it's intuitive to me. I've known this for 40 years. It's one reason I moved up to Northern California and kind of got out of the city. It's not sustainable. It's not rational. How irrational can a society get? And you're kind of painting this picture. 2050 is another wall where if we double our consumption again, especially of fossil fuels, and have again the biosphere, well, we're not separate from that biosphere. Everything is connected. Right. So if we don't respond to this, we are basically too stupid to survive. And I guess that's why, you know, I do these shows. I want people to wake up. Hello, America, big red flag. We are the leaders in the world. Yes, it would take a global effort, as you said, but we know these things are possible. We have COP21. They came to agreements that we should have come to 20 years ago. Thank you, George W. But we could have been much further down the road if we didn't let politicians and if we didn't let special interests take us down the wrong road. And we're talking about part of what Jacobson talks about is, first of all, the sun and the wind are constantly, you know, I mean, day and night in different situations. But basically, we have free energy every place where the sun shines and the wind blows, which is most of the earth at some time, day or night. So if we were to make use of that in the sense that it would stop the degradation of our biosphere, at the same time, you're not paying somebody to go drill a well or go tear up, some mountaintops in West Virginia. There's none of that cost is there. So once you have this other infrastructure in place, which we know we can build wealth by building out the infrastructure, we did it for years and years. It's only been recently that we haven't reinvested in our own civilization, our own society, where, go back to the fat cats, there's that fat cream on the top, right? Well, the greedy scrape the cream off the top, and a lot of people will tell you this is what's going on economically too. There's very little reinvestment in our civilization, and there's very little real governance. I think you see this in the present elections. Some of these things are very predictable. And I guess I'm saying is, how can we not? Where you are kind of cynical or more realistic, if you want to term it that way, where you're more realistic in the sense of thermodynamics and physics and past and present, looking forward and extrapolating out to the future, yes, it looks bad if business as usual, as we call it, if that goes on, we're hopelessly lost. But I think more and more people are getting that message. And if they don't, then we have to think that basically our civilization is bringing about its own demise. And I guess the fat cats may not be willing to save us. I think who is it? Ralph Nader had a book that the super rich are the only people that can save us are the super rich or something to that effect a couple years back. And so we're already seeing the failures. We're seeing the failures of democracy. We're seeing the failures in our economy, which is pretty much a house of cards. We're seeing, basically, we're choking on our own fat. We're choking on that consumption of energy. And so I'm pessimistic, but at the same time, I think there are solutions. And if we don't reach for them now, we don't stand a chance. What would you predict? And I don't know if you want to go this far. I had Jared Diamond a couple of years ago on, and I asked him, how long is this civilization going to last? Because this is a great part of his work. And he said, 10 years probably, maybe a little more, something like a decade. And so do you have any idea we're going to reach some point where this cannot go on? Maybe that's measured in CO2. Maybe we can talk about CO2 and some of your climate studies that you've done in the polar area. What are our chances? These things, if we go into an abrupt climate change, do you see that through some of your calculations?
Well, 10 years is absurdly fast. It's not going to be 10 years. The thing is, we are growing extremely quickly right now. Civilization currently is extremely robust. Things do not change overnight. I mean, the most powerful force in the universe is inertia. Things that are growing now are most likely going to continue to grow, and they will grow for as long as they can based on past favorable forces until they can't, because there may be an accumulation of negative forces that eventually slow things down and perhaps switch things over. But that's not going to be the 10 years. I don't see that as being even remotely possible. It could, however, be relatively soon. I mean, we lie along a continuum of both growth and collapse at the same time. Growth creates the seeds for collapse, and as we are growing, the forces of collapse become stronger and stronger. But right now, growth is winning, and it will continue to win for the next few decades. I do not see a way around that.
Yeah, I should have been clear. I mean, what Jared Diamond is talking about is collapse of civilization in the U.S., collapse of our society. And so he wasn't talking about, overcome by CO2 or climate change or, weather instability. He was talking about civilization. So that's not a fair comparison.
I don't see that because, the United States is still a very rich country. The globe is still very rich. And material resources and energy resources, and of course the biosphere will continue to increasingly suffer, but those resources are still out there for a while. But the things do have to start kicking in as what economists might call negative externalities. There are things like environmental degradation that will eventually start to take over, and that's where I foresee that, you know, in the time scale of decades, but not years. Things will happen. We lie along a continuum of growth and collapse. One thing I think I will say with regards to your prior comments, with regards to solutions, myself, I believe that the universe is deterministic. Things will unfold as they will unfold, in the same way that they will have always been determined to unfold. And I see this as a direct result of the laws of physics, specifically thermodynamics. But I appreciate that others would not share that point of view, and perhaps appeal more to human agency. But one thing I do believe is that if there is a solution out there, we should be very critical of those who advertise things that may be fairy tales, that are things that are as they might wish them to be. There may not be clear solutions that are the most obvious ones. It turns out from the work I've done, for example, that pursuing increased energy efficiency, if nothing, it probably makes things worse rather than better, because it aids the health of civilization. And the healthier civilization is, the more it consumes. So the obvious solutions may not, in fact, be the right ones. And I think if we are to find solutions, we should not be pursuing goals or plans or fairy tales, whatever they are. We should be trying to understand how the system really works, because it is only by understanding how civilization works that we can then start to think about how the future might change if there were certain adjustments that might be made. That's where I, as a scientist, I would prefer to see the focus, not on politics.
Well, Tim, we are out of time. This hour has just gone so fast. Did you have some websites or other places people can go to read about your work and something before we sign off here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest thing is I find my own websites with a Google search. But if people put my name with economics and physics, Tim Garrett, and economic and physics into Google, they'll probably find some either press releases or my own websites where I try to describe the ideas in fairly lay terms.
Well, Tim, we are out of time. I want to thank you for being on Unspun with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and maybe we'll check in with you again a little further down the line.
I look forward to it.
If we have that much time, and I'm sure we do. Okay, thank you for being on Unspun.
Yeah, thanks again.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Our guest today has been Professor Tim Garrett, head of the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. We have been discussing the thermodynamics of civilization, what that portends for the human species and future generations. As usual, I've put links to his works and articles on kkrn.org/shows/unspun, along with the archives of this show. Next week on Unspun, we'll be talking with Pamela Spoto about Black history and Black lives in America. Tune in Saturday mornings, 9 a.m., for your dose of Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5. Next up, Peace Talks Radio.